Welcome to Starving the Universe On Call. I'm Paul Prentice, owner of Prentice Games. I run SW9, Dead Come Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, join us with a talk guest every Thursday night starting 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone to dial 605-562-0444, just follow the directions, call ID is 17702. Or you can sit on the web, just go to the Talkshow website and look, search for call ID 17702 or Starfleet Universe On Call. I don't think you can find my SV on call, but, you know, whatever. But if you want the best online experience, what you want to go to, twitch.tv at twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. Maybe I'll join the chat room there and see my lovely face as we stream live. Yes, live. And, of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is SFUOnCall@gmail.com. It's SFUONCALL@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on the Twitters, yes, I still call it Twitter, you can go to podcasting account, which is SFU on call, or you can follow my personal account, which is Paul Franz, PaulFranz, and of course, there's Franz Games, FranzGmes, and there's no T in that. Of course, also, I have accounts on Blue Sky. Yes, I'm on Blue Sky. So if you want to follow a podcasting account, there's SFU on call at bsky.social. When it comes to my personal/business account, that's friendsgames.com. So feel free to follow me there. And I'm right now taking a break from social media for Lent, and I will be back on it after Lent, after I do a little more thinking about exactly what I will do with it. At least when it comes to the Blue Sky, because I don't think I'm going to be doing much posting on Twitter. But anyhow, getting to the news from ADB. Not much there going on, but ADB that was working on updating Module K, which would be quite cool because Module K is the PF module, which would be quite cool to see. Also, Gene was busy proofreading on the Orion Master Starship book. Still, you know, getting through that a little bit at a time. And of course, this week on Found on the online store, we have the FedCom Distant Kingdoms Gas Giant map panels. There are two map panels. Both of them together cost $8. I don't think you can buy them separately, but you can put together only $8. And then, of course, there's two map panels. One's the large gas giant. Another one is a small gas giant map panel. So you can enjoy both those panels for only $8, especially if you lost yours or the dog got it. It'd be a nice replacement if you want to have those panels, because they're quite beautiful. I love a lot of the art that's on some of these maps. They picked up some really beautiful ones. Moving on and forward, come the SFU Online tournaments. Of course, we have this is my Star 2, which actually, Metal Dog, that's Justin Rudy, won, defeated Bill Scheller in the Klingon in the finals. When it comes to 500 BBV tournament, we have round two is all set. We have Dana Medson, who's flying a Klingon, versus Eddie Crutchfield, who's also flying a Fed. Now, of course, we have another Fed in the other part of the tree, which is Justin Rudy. He defeated his opponent, and don't get started. And they're playing against moi, because I just kind of defeated my Fed opponent. Got to play against another Fed. This, you know, really, guys, can you play something other than Federation? This makes things interesting, you know. But no, that's the way it went. Sigh, deep sigh. Comes a library port. Not much happening there. Actually, I think I got a couple updates from Frank. I need to post them up. And I apologize, I have not posted up the FRDs in the FedCom library. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, yes, along with Paul Franz, welcoming you to Star from the Universe On Call. And tonight, we've got Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
And we have Doug. Say hi, Doug.
Hey, Doug.
Cool. So we all are here.
Don't mind. Yay.
Making sure that I am actually, let me adjust this just a tiny bit. Move the camera just to show my wonderful face a little more. Sorry, people. If you want to see the background, sorry. Anyway. Tonight's topic, or topics. I'm willing to bet Gary's here because he wanted to talk about the Carnivon's alternate history number two. Or there's another...
Not right this moment.
Okay.
Because you might have seen on the BBS that a couple of topics have blown up over the last couple of days. One of them being the feedback over the 500 BPV tournaments. And another one, proposal about trying to basically figure out what, if any, kind of mission variants might be useful for the Gorns. The two topics are basically not unrelated to each other, but some of the conversation has been happening in parallel because not everyone is taking part in both topics. So some discussions are kind of, you know, echoing each other, but not corresponding to each other, if that makes sense. But
yeah,
it is something that, and actually, I actually wanted to talk about you, to mention you as well, because there was, unfortunately, it seems that not everyone is tuning in to listen to the podcast to get your thoughts on the event. So I actually posted a link to the talk show in the discussion in case anyone wanted to have a listen, because apparently the guy running the event, Jeffrey Clark, he actually was complaining to say that he basically thinks that you've been pretty tight-lipped in terms of your feedback. And of course we know that's not the case here, but
right.
I don't know if everyone's got like a 5 hour spare to listen to those episodes back in terms of the feedback. So this is not me trying to throw you under the bus, far from it. I would never do that. It's just more, I'm just basically relaying the feedback, or that seems to be kind of coming up, is that basically if it's not being posted in that BBS discussion, then it seems to be kind of like other people are just kind of treating it as like not happening. So despite the fact that hopefully, you know, after posting the link, some people are popping in to have a listen to get a better sense of what's going on. I mean, ideally, I don't know if you want to invite some of the people like to come on the talk and, you know, discuss their own thoughts about how the tournament's gone so far and where it might go from here, that sort of thing. Because it feels like there's too many parallel conversations and not enough crossover between those conversations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, people are cross-talking and not really communicating. Understood.
Well, more in the sense that basically, like, we're having this conversation here, and some people are having a conversation in one of the threads that's on the BBS, and then some, but not all of those same people are having a different discussion because, to start things off, I just wanted to say that I don't know if it might be worth doing some sort of like after action report, a Cliff Notes version of your feedback over the last few episodes worth, and just posting a little bit so that people can read it in that BBS thread, the 500 BPV one, just to kind of help, break through that impression that there hasn't been any feedback, because, you know, as I say, the more people can, you know, get involved in that conversation, whether it's on the BBS or here in the talk show, the better.
Well, for love of Pete. Well, the same things that I think are, I really don't want to get involved in the most part about the 500 BBV tournament. One of those things is map size. And I'm not flying a seeking weapon race. I'm flying a direct fire, I mean, purely a direct fire race. The only closest thing to staking weapons are my shuttles. So it's hard for me to give a good feel of, okay, is the map too large? Now, to a certain degree, I agree the map seems a little too large just because it takes, if I wouldn't have gone as fast as I went to start off, you know, game number one, if I would have gotten to the range I wanted to get, we wouldn't have had any interaction for two turns. Because I was flying across the board at over 20 hexes, you know, the speed 20, over speed 20. My opponent was going a speed like 12. Now, you know, obviously he was engaging, so he was moving, but relatively, most part, at least from the beginning of the game, he was going very slow. He didn't go. Didn't really move any faster until he got later on in the game. Now, when it comes to some of the other things that actually I'm saying that they discuss, because the problem is the discussion goes so flying by that I don't have time to always check it. Obviously, Peter has Peter always has had this. Which is, Peter said, always had a good write-up for his battles. I suck. I truly suck at doing write-ups for my battles. Because, you know, I can write up generic things, but they're not going to really give people much information about what's going on in the battle. I don't think so. And usually, to do any write-ups whatsoever, it takes me number of hours, which is insane. You know, to write up the 9 turns that we did, that will take me over 2 hours to write up a good enough description on that battle. Possibly enough, maybe 3 hours. I could probably do better things with my time than running a battle description. If they really want me to, I'll be happy to. And I do mean this. I'll be happy to take the 9 hours of video. Actually, more than, I think it's 9 hours. Around 9 hours of video I've recorded and make it available to them. And if they want to, I can even speed it up. So they can watch it on YouTube and watch the full battle in all its glory. You know? And even as I do my energy allocations, I'll be happy to do that. You know, if they want to, they can obviously go to my YouTube channel and go to YouTube and actually watch, giving a breakdown on the battle, you know, that I did for 3 weeks in a row. Trying to give insights of what's going on, relatively short description of what's going on in the battle. If you look at it, it was 3 episodes. That means it was over 3 hours long to go through my battle of what happened, the points of the battle that I recorded. In the case when it comes to before the battle ended, to the final turn where I actually played out what I've been doing, you know. And in one case, I think I did a boo boo, but neither my opponent nor I really realized it at the time. So, and I gotta love this. I agree. One thing. What Justin say? Let me see. Is this one thing, Justin? I think. Where is it? I agree. I think it was Justin said this, that just to quote there, this is the over analysis of a single battle and conclusion drawn deeply flawed. I disagree with that point, deeply flawed. There's no issue with the size, map size, or with plasma or drones. Overall, I think the conclusion, I agree with Jeff saying that it's deeply flawed, is is wrong. It's, I don't think it's deeply flawed. I think the issue with plasma and such a large map, yeah. Here, okay. Okay, let's back up for a moment. Let's freaking back up just for a freaking moment. If we want back up here just for a moment, when it comes to Peter's experience and Peter's experience, or at least this is from what I know about Peter. I don't think Peter's played many fleet battles. So I don't feel like, I think Peter's experience with plasma so far has been in the fishbowl. In the fishbowl, plasma can be very effective because you only can run so much from plasma. You only can run so much from your seeking weapons, whether it's plasma or drones. And this fleet battle and the fleet battles that we currently have, it changes things a bit. Because of, again, we're gonna go back to how I feel about seeking weapons themselves. Seeking weapons, in my mind, are not too designed to impact your opponent. Seeking weapons are designed for one thing: they're mobile terrain. The strength of a plasma torpedo, the number of drones, those all give you a certain amount of strength of, and therefore a threat, and therefore something you can't just, you know, wipe out and just drive right through. That's the whole idea of having lots of drones. Launching a plasma R, you know, or, you know, even worse, you know, an enveloping plasma R. That's going to force your opponent to do what? Turn. They have to turn either left or right, or, and this is insane to do, especially when you have a very mobile fleet, which is stop. Which is, you know, and use a wild weasel. And of course, that is the most insane tactic to do with a mobile fleet running at your back, which has more seeking weapons. Really bad. Now, so they're not designed as much to inflict damage. And that's the thing with seeking weapons. Now, there is, of course, the minor issue here now, and that is in a open terrain, like we have a pretty open terrain that we have. We're still fighting in a fishbowl. The fishbowl is quite big, so it gives you a lot more room to move, maneuver. And given that you have that room to maneuver, you then can do certain things that normally you can't. You can actually outrun the plasma relatively easy. You can keep the drones, you know, stacked up. And of course, there is a limitation on the number of drones. Though, of course, when the fleet battle, you have a lot more drones that be on the board at any one time. Fortunately, we don't have the insane, or truly, truly freaking insane idea. And I'm so glad Jeff nixed this from the beginning, which is the whole idea of having fighters. No, not on your freaking life. Because if you have fighters, when it comes to the Feds, probably in the Zinnies, maybe even the Klingons, any drone using race, they're going to have so many freaking drones on the board, it's going to be absolutely insane. And for the amount of BPV that those little itty bitty fighters are worth as drone platforms, you know, they can kill you. Can you imagine a 500 BPV fleet, which had a carrier, maybe a couple escorts, and then just fighters? It would be absolutely insane.
Agreed to some degree. I mean, that's why he didn't have fighters in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's why he said no carriers.
Yes. Oh, that's the only thing.
But also, the thing about seeking weapons is mobile terrain is kind of a relative thing. You know, some are meant to be used as impactors. And all seeking weapons can be used as mobile terrain. And they make their own immediate mobile terrain when you launch them. But at the end of the day, you got to get some hits with some of them. So.
Depends on the
And it also depends upon the faction you're running. Because some of them, it's their primary weapon. Some of them, it's a percentage of their weaponry. And some of them, it's like a tertiary extra thing. So. Yeah, take it for what you will. I mean, it is what it is. I know that's so cliche, but there it is. So.
Yeah. Well,
part of the conversation that's coming up is whether or not it's the Gorns in particular that have a problem. And part of it is actually because it would have been, because you might recall that before the tournament started, there were a few tweaks in terms of whether or not you could take a single ship that had a year in service date after Y-180, or right. In your case, technically the Saltorian ships existed, it's just that they weren't in the Alpha Octant in Y-180, but, you know, the Saltorians were allowed to take the Y-184, like, T-bombs and stuff like that.
Right,
sort of thing.
Right.
And so that also basically means that you could take a heavy war destroyer, even though some of the heavy war destroyers don't historically exist until after Y-180, but it's possible to take one. So, one thing that came up in the conversation is that Peter seems to have, he missed that update when he was drawing his force together.
Right.
And, but I guess in retrospect, it would have been possible now. So, and the reason why I mentioned this is because it's possible to take a Gorn heavy battle destroyer and to install a pair of plasma D racks into the aft firing heavy weapon mounts. And if you have two plasma D racks rather than one, you don't have to set them both in an AP arc. You can set one in LPR and RPR. So kind of like a pseudo ISC, so to speak.
Right.
And my view, such as it was, is that kind of looking at like the serious issues that the squadron he did take had with speed 32 drones, especially how many that because the Klingon force is very drone heavy, like it had a C7, it has a D6D, and it had two E4s, and so that's not only just like the basic seeking weapon capacity that the two bigger ships have, it's also the use of the special sensor to add it. But Dana was talking about Dana Madsen, I believe, was basically talking about how at no point did he feel that he had to worry about any kind of like limit on the seeking weapon control, that he was basically able to control. He could have done more, but in terms of like having more drones on the board, which is a sobering thought. But part of the issue is that the Gorn fleet that had been taken was relying on its phasers and on the occasional carronade of Plasma F. But using a carronade for Plasma F basically, it means that you can only fire it once per turn, and then you're going to have to wait just, you know, a few more turns to have that Plasma F be a thing you can launch as a torpedo. And, you know, in the historical timeline, carronades were primarily intended to help dealing with cloaked ships. So if you're in a duo, a carronade is fine, because you basically overrun the area where the Romulan ship is there, and use the carronade to try to help you know, score damage even like in the face of the like cloaking or uncloaking sort of thing. But it's not, and you can actually pick out individual seeking weapons with the carronade if you're in like a smaller action, like a, because I think apparently is it true that the Gorns aren't allowed to carronade in the single ship tournament, like the
correct.
Module T tournament, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, because that's probably the reason why is because they think that it might be, they don't want to give the Gorns that opportunity to overrun every turn. It seems that unless you've got a really bad dual setup, the Gorns are okay. But the question is, once you start getting into larger squadron or fleet engagements, do the Gorns start having trouble with the large numbers of drones then? And so, in theory, it would be interesting to see, like, say, if that scenario, like that drone-heavy Klingon force was fighting a Gorn force, but if the Gorn force was modified to maybe remove, like, one of the ships in order to make room for a heavy battle destroyer with those plasmid racks, how differently would the thing have turned out? Because on the one hand, plasmids have the defensive fire mode where they can you can get a number of them on the board to shoot down drones quickly, but then plasmid racks only have 4 warheads, and then you have to take them offline for a turn to reload. So
right.
The trick would be, do you basically use both racks in the same turn if you're facing a large drone wave, and then have no drone defense the following turn, and then try to survive till turn 3 so you can use them again? Or do you alternate the racks where you use all 4 of one rack and keep the other one spare, and then use the spare one when you've got the reload turn on the first rack, and so on and so on?
Right.
Is that better? So, but then that would be an interesting thing, because there's not enough data points. Because right. I think, I guess just to double the side off for a second, I do think that a round robin tournament would have been better for it this time around, because having everybody play each other at least once, I think, would have given more useful data in terms of being able to
understand
how well this format functions. And also, right. It would be interesting to basically do a victory point based league total, so that you're basically judging like what the final result would be in a more nuanced way than just the win-loss kind of column, if that makes sense. But anyway,
yeah, actually,
so then that makes the other
a really
question
good idea.
Yeah, so I it's probably too late for this tournament because they seem to be moving towards the semi-final round, but I think tournament number 2 should be a round robin. And then maybe with a playoff at the end or something, kind of like the World Baseball Classic, but there should be some sort of league table because, you know, give people the opportunity to actually play these games and then talk about them on the BBS or here on the talk show, so that enough data can be drawn up and also people can have this more skin in the game, so to speak. I think that would be a lot better. But I guess you can take an iterative approach. Run a similar battle, but put in that battle destroyer with the heavy battle destroyer with the plasmid racks. Are there enough plasma racks to make a difference? If so, then maybe it's less of an issue for the Gorns. But if not, then do they need some other thing? And that's why I started a thread where I was proposing that the Gorns could get a couple of support variant ships, which would basically, like, say, for example, if you took a heavy destroyer and replaced all its plasma torpedoes with D racks. And then used it kind of like the same way that the Federation uses a new drone cruiser, except that the Federation can leverage the new drone cruiser much better for offensive actions, whereas this proposed plasma cruiser would be the plasma variant cruiser would be more of a fleet support variant or squadron support. The handy thing with that is that you wouldn't have to worry about Aegis fire control, because one of the ideas that was bandied around was to basically break the rule against allowing fleet escorts in the Alpha Octant, rather. Because in Omega and the LMC, it's more fuzzy. But in Alpha, you know, you usually have to have a carrier for the escort to get to escort. But there was some suggestions to basically let the Gorns take an Aegis escort so that its plasma D-racks can be leveraged along with the Aegis. But I guess part of me was thinking that maybe Aegis would be too powerful a thing to give a non-carrier escort in this kind of setup. So that's why I was thinking that it might be better to have a standalone variant that doesn't have Aegis. But whether or not that's going to happen is another story, because the ADB doesn't seem entirely sold on the idea. So, I mean, that's fine. I mean, if the idea doesn't work, it doesn't work. But that still leaves the underlying question, are the Gorns in trouble without it? And is that a problem? Because historically, it's only rarely a problem because they only fight the Klingons a couple of times during the General War. But there are alternate timelines where they fight drone empires much more prominently. Like, for example, we talked before about the module R4J and how there's a bad guy universe with the Feds or the Federal Imperium. And so the Gorns would be at war with them. And so they'd have to worry about using their drones against them. And so if that's so, is the current Gorn fleet enough in terms of its options against drones? Or if not, what would they use? So that's basically one thread of the recent conversation that I wanted to bring up. So I guess I wanted to kind of put that by you and see, did you think that in that the Gorns might have that issue, or do you think it's just more, it needs to be approached in a different way?
Well, the biggest, seriously have a question about that whole thing. Like, for instance, was he having a hard time against a specific opponent in this, or is this a hypothetical?
This is a specific opponent, the Klingons.
Okay, and he had a hard time with it. Mm-hmm. Was he bolting his stuff, or was he launching and watching his opponent run away while the drones came after him? I think this might be addressable through tactics. Like, did he have T-bombs? Use T-bombs to negate the drones? Because his opponent only has a limited number of drones, ultimately. And judicious use of T-bombs in a fleet setting could potentially wipe out lots of them and maybe run them out. And quite frankly, it's, you know, if he's out there, even if he's just fast charging his Fs and bolting, he could be bolting instead of launching plasma. So there's just, I wonder if that might be addressable through tactics and some selections rather than changing the whole rule setup. But if you really want to have a rules change in your setup, the thing that comes to mind might be something like letting all the ships, all the fleets have an Orion package option kind of thing, like they do in the regular tournament setup where the Orion has an A and B package. So if you know you're going in against, you know, you can design a fleet that is meant to deal with drone users specifically, and you can design a fleet that's meant to deal with everything else. And he has his option A, option B package. So he could choose a different ship setup just for if he goes in against Kazinis and or a Fed who he knows has a drone heavy setup or a Klingon or something of that nature. I mean, that's just a random thought. I mean, it's not going to change it during this particular tournament. But, you know, from me, just what you said, with such a huge map, and you're playing a plasma chucker versus a drone chucker, the thing is, the drone guy can be run out of his drones. And you can do significant damage with plasma without launching it and using it as mobile terrain. So, I don't know. I think that's, maybe it's something that could be sat down and played out a few times outside of a tournament setting just to see how that kind of matchup can be tweaked and worked. You know, otherwise, if you go into a second tournament like this, maybe an A-B option where it can't be radically different necessarily, but it could be a difference of, say, switching out one frigate to be anti-drone support frigate, you know, like you were saying about letting him have that. Well, the problem is if he has that, but he's stuck with it against everybody else who's not a drone race, then he's being handicapped in a totally different way. So, just a random thought there.
Well, No. I mean, there's actually been a number of posts in the BB and in this the 500 BPV thread, both from Peter and from Dana, because the Peter was the one flying the Gorns, and the Klingons were being flown by Dana. Now, and Dana actually pointed out that he went with a conspicuously drone-heavy Klingon force, because like one might expect that like a Klingon force will have mainly like disruptor variants, so the drones wouldn't be that many. But in this case, he started with a C7. Now, the C7, I believe, has double seeking weapon control as it is.
The C7 is insane.
But it then also he went with a D6D. So that basically has got six more drone wrecks. And also it's got the special sensors. So I think one of those sensors can be assigned to add additional seeking control. But I think he said that that wasn't an issue for him. And then I think he had two E4s, I believe. And so
correct.
Part of the issue from Peter's perspective, in terms of the feedback that has been posted on the BBS, I strongly recommend if you have a chance to head over to the BBS sometime and just read through some of the feedback. There's some quite informative stuff. But one of the comments was made with that. So because the drones were speed, because the tournament is set in Y-180, the drones are speed 32. Plasma Empire, Plasma Empires have Sabo torpedoes, which are speed 40. But the feedback to date, at least for this one battle, because again, you're right, more data is required. But the feedback for now seems to be that the Sabo didn't make that big a difference, whereas the speed 32 drones meant that any turn that the Klingons, even if they were at a considerable distance from the Gorns, they were able to basically launch, what did he say, about 12 to 14 fast drones each turn. And then by the time the Gorns tried to close the range to get closer to the Klingons, there'd be like another batch of fast drones. And because the drones are speed 32, they're much more difficult to avoid. Like if they were still speed 24, then the Gorns would have more options in terms of being able to try to get around them. But when they're speed 32, it's much more problematic, because even a speed 40 Sabo torpedo starts losing its warhead strength, whereas the speed 32 drones, their warhead stays the same until you kill them or until they kill you. So Peter, with the selection of ships that he took, which again, to go back to the whole heavy battle destroyer thing, maybe it would have turned out differently if he had had that heavy battle destroyer with the plasma V Rex and salt, but maybe not. But his experience was that he found it significantly very difficult to be able to deal with each successive drone wave in the intervals that they were coming in, because they were coming in so fast and more and more were being launched in. In order for him to have basically enough firepower left over and to get to a close enough range to be able to leverage the firepower that he had. Now, the game didn't necessarily, it wasn't a whitewash by any sense. I think it was only like a marginal victory. So, you know, had things gone a little bit differently, that would have been a thing. But it did seem to speak to a potential issue that the Gorns might have had relative to like other empires. So for example, like if you're flying a Romulan fleet, then if you've got a lot of drones incoming, you cloak, and you know if any of the drones don't have Type 3 warheads, then they're in trouble. But and if you're the ISC have PPDs, so they can, you know, they have that long range hitting power, but also they have those side plasma F and rear firing plasma F and the phaser 3 refit. So they actually have significant attrition unit defense baked into their late warships or their pacification airships, rather. And the Gorns don't necessarily have that. Now, I'm not calling on the Gorns to get further refits on their line ships. I would not suggest that. I think somebody was suggesting trying to go back to the old Plasma D refit that apparently the Commander's Edition Gorns had, and I don't agree with that personally. So I would sooner say that it would make more sense to have a dedicated fleet support ship that's helping the other ships deal with drones, rather than the entire fleet trying to pretend they're ISC in terms of having all these cool tricks that they can use. So, basically that is kind of the main thing that comes up. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I'd say, you know, several more battles would be worth playing out. And also, I think it would be interesting to see, like, had a Klingon force been taken that was more quote-unquote traditional Klingon, like, maybe, okay, here's the thing. Paul, I was hoping you'd get your advice on this too. So the D6D is a fleet bombardment variant, especially because it's got the special sensors. Like, the Klingons themselves are very, they're not exactly in a hurry to put them into a squadron because they want to use them for long-range bombardment. Because in, like, things like Federation and Empire, for example, the because the ship has special sensors, it can actually use, you know, the Type 3 XX drones to be able to, like, send bombardment missions further across the map. So risking a D6D in a small squadron battle is probably not wise. So I actually wonder, now that this is, I probably should post about this in the BBS, but I wonder, should a future Klingon force, or Khazinti force for that matter, not be able to take a heavy battle cruiser and a heavy drone ship like that at once? Like, they could maybe take a drone frigate or something, but a unit that has special sensors and a whole bunch of drone racks and stuff, whether it's Klingon or Khazinti, those are supposed to be reserved. So you can have it and as the centerpiece of your force or whatever, but you can't also have the C7. And that means that whatever other ships that you have in your fleet, maybe they have more disruptors, so in a direct fire sense, they're still dangerous, but they don't have all the scary toys that this Klingon force was able to take. So, you know, does that, I don't know if that makes sense, because maybe for the Khazintis too, because I'm pretty sure they have a bombardment cruiser that has special sensors as well, and I don't know if that's a wise to let them have that and have a Khazinti heavy battle cruiser, because that's way too many drones to consider, you know, down a dark alleyway. So, yeah, do you think that would make sense? Or, like, do you think that maybe the Klingon should have just been obliged to take a less scary drone, a less drone scary ship instead of that D60? Or would that have been another way to approach it for a tournament perspective?
Well, okay. Here's the thing when it comes to the D60. The D60 is a drone bombardment ship. It's designed for launching drones. Now, how many drone racks does it have? I know it has...
I don't have the SSD in front of me, but yeah. I want to say 6. But it's got the cargo space, so it can actually store, like...
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
A few hundred
cargo space doesn't matter. Here's the reason why, the only reason cargo space does not matter. The only reason cargo space that matters at all when it comes to drones is if you're able to reload the racks. And that means that you have to take your rack offline to reload the rack. So it's not like you can continually just keep on launching drones without stopping. Now, so say you rotate two out, so you only can launch 4 drones per turn if you're actually wanting to reload these things. Now, you know, obviously, there can be, I think, an argument made that especially ships like drone bombardment ships should not be allowed in the normal fleet. Because, as you said, they're special, just like Maulers. Maulers should not be allowed. Because Maulers aren't designed, for the most part, for fleets. Maulers are mainly designed for one thing and one thing only. They're designed for attacking bases. That is their design. That's what they're built to do, is base busting. So, yeah, there, in my mind, there is a good point to be made that certain ships should not be allowed in the fleet. Because here's the thing. Here's the gotcha. The original, if we go back to Capitol number 15, I think it is. Okay. Anyway, the original scenario, the original plan, they had fixed fleets. You did not get to choose your fleet. You get to choose what empire you wanted to fly, but you didn't get to choose the ships that are in that fleet. The problem with choosing your own ships is that little stupid number, BPV. BPV, that one little number, really cannot, it's supposed to be how powerful a ship it is, how good it has defense and offense into a single number. And in my mind, that is one insane, because it gives you a general feeling for how valuable that ship is, but that's about it. Next, that reminds me, that's one thing I want to look up, which was okay, one thing that I'm not sure was done in, now, I don't think, obviously, the Gorn versus Klingon, this I don't think this really matters, though I'd have to check it with the D6D, which is scouts, if you recall, that any scout that's engaged in a fleet battle is no longer to be, you no longer use the BPV value for the BPV. You use the EPV, the actual economic value for the BPV for scouts, which are usually are not quite, they're like at least a 50% more cost than the normal BPV value for that ship. I'm not sure if that was done in this case. I didn't actually go through the numbers for all the ships.
I think you actually kind of nailed it already. Well, the big problem with the big potential problem with it is the customization factor.
Right.
And yeah, if you had like a standard fleet for everybody, and you said you want to be Klingon and you had the choice, you had Klingon A or Klingon B. You know, Klingon A might be a generic general against most races, and then B might be if you have to fight one of the plasma chuckers. You know, a slightly different variant with some commander's options. I think that would probably make for a better tournament setup than everybody custom designs their own fleet on the BPV, because it takes the whole rock, paper, scissors, shotgun concept way beyond what you would normally have, because the game is so complex that you can easily make a fleet maybe that is effectively unbeatable by a specific other faction, or that will just rompel stomp because you found that one ship combination. And when they had those generic fleet setups in those earlier captain's logs for the concept, I think that is probably where maybe you should look at going for the next tournament, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
Yeah, I understand the reasoning behind wanting to select your own ships, because if you go back many, many years ago, when we created the Federation Commander one, where the idea was that you would pick out your ships, then you would actually take your ships, give them to the judges. The judges would then look over your fleet and go, okay, you know, basically they'd say, okay, this is a valid fleet or not a valid fleet. Most of the time it's just BPV, but I'm sure there's other conditions that could easily have been applied that, you know, say, oh, you know, you have two of these super duper ships. It's like, no, you can't. You can have one. You know. People want to create their own fleets. But as I said, the problem with that, it's like the tournament ships themselves. The Sherman ships, they're based off some rough ships, usually like the CA, BR, not battle raider. I mean,
command cruisers mostly.
Command cruiser or new command cruisers.
Well, yeah, or CA.
Right. Yeah. Basically that's what they're based on. And that point, then they were tweaked because of the different empires that they were facing. Well, it's possible that's what we have to go back to for the fleet one, which is, okay, we have to define these are the ships that will be used. If you want to play Fed, these are the ships you get. If you want to play the Gorns, these are the ships you get. Or possibly come up with different ship selections. In other words, here you can choose, as you point out, Doug, the idea of having packages, but in this case, they were pre-selected packages. Okay, you can choose this one, or choose this one, or choose this one, but that's it. You can't create your own ships. Now, again, this is the first time we've ever done this before, so hopefully...
A learning experience.
Right, so it's a learning experience. And given the learning experience... Gary, I understand your need and the idea of having it a round robin. Overall, the idea of it, good idea. Problem. Each one of these battles takes somewhere between 9 to 16 hours to play out. That's a lot of time to dedicate to playing one game. So making a round robin means that you might have to play somewhere around 50 hours of play just to get to the first round.
Yeah. Well, not really.
A couple of things.
Not really.
Right now,
the first round would
first
be
round
like
is
all that.
Over, but half the people are not involved in the second round, so they don't have any of these battles. There's actually... Someone is in the BBS thread trying to steal players to use for some other campaign or something. So it's basically like if there's a certain like month long window or whatever, in which case each round is being played, if other players would otherwise want to be playing, but they can't play because they've been eliminated, if it's a single elimination tournament, why not let them play? Like basically, and the other thing is, so I kind of felt, because like, as I say, we'll see how it goes in the semifinals, but I mean, I suspect that the people that got eliminated, I mean, unless there was like some sort of real life thing stopping them from playing in the next one, which is quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would have assumed that they would have been there to play in the next round. So it's not basically adding a workload they weren't willing to take on. So I think a round robin, like basically it would still, you know, if the people are willing to engage with it within, like have round one be, you know, March, and then round two be like April, and then round three, so on. So that there is enough time in theory for each round to finish entirely before the next round is selected and, you know, played, then that would still, you know, give people a chance to remain engaged with it if they so wish. So, but the other thing too is I would say that all of the blind forces that people have been submitting for Captain's Log for years now, they generally are pretty good. I mean, ADB have gotten quite clever and are not quite extensive in terms of basically making sure that people only have certain gotchas, or if any, like they try to eliminate the amount of gotchas that they can have. They'll basically say, here's the year of the force you assemble. Here are the things you can't take at all. Maybe one issue of Captain's Log, they'll say, you can take this type of ship. And then the next issue, they'll say, no, you can't. Or, but, you know, like, for example, like maybe there was a sort of round of submissions that said, you can't have any size class 3 ships. And then another one said that you have to have at least one size class 3 ship or whatever. So, or you have to have it with a move cost or whatever, which got weird for the four of them. But anyway, basically, it still allowed players to be able to decide a significant extent of what specific ships they were taking. But it prevented them from gaming the system to the point where they'd cause trouble. And also, the other thing as well is because in the Captain's Log scenarios, like the battle groups rather, you never know what squadron you're going to be paired up against, if at all. But right. Usually, like, there's been like several issues worth in which people have been paired off, but they don't know that until after their submissions have been locked in. So the onus is on trying to be as careful as you can in terms of having a well-rounded force that, in theory at least, is not vulnerable to a gotcha from another force. But it also means that you, in turn, don't have that gotcha to apply to someone else. So I feel that I would be somewhat wary of taking away the opportunity of people to have some degree of input in what their tournament squadron should be like. Like, if they want to take E4s instead of E3s, then, or E4s instead of F5s, whatever, then, you know, I mean, they can see if that's a fair trade, or if the Andromedans are allowed in. Like, does the Andromedan player take Mambas, or does he take Cobras? You know, that sort of thing. There are definitely there's more work that can be done, and I do think that the Captain's Log, I mean, I've said this before, but I do think that the Captain's Log battle group experience, which is quite extensive, lends itself to this setup, even if it's not going to be quite as unexpected as many of the Captain's Log scenarios have been. But the general concept that people have basically been trained by ADB over several years to plan, you're taking a force for such and such points, and you have to expect action, but you don't know what it is, and you've got certain restrictions that you have to bear in mind. I think that that applies. That is definitely transferable to a significant degree to the concept of the way the tournament is proposed to be set up. But And also as well, because I feel that, I mean, like I've mentioned in the thread that I'm hoping that Paravians and Carnivals and other empires could be added to this tournament in the future. I'd be somewhat concerned if the only way that an empire, old or new, was allowed in the tournament is if you basically pre-cooked the squadron and handed it to a person. Because, I mean, getting people interested in some of these new factions itself can be a challenge. But if you're doing it and basically at the same time having to invent a squadron that a player can have and then make them have that squadron, I'm not sure if that would be all that enticing in terms of the polls, like the actual getting people, more people to get involved in it. So, yeah, I mean, like, there's definitely a lot of factors to consider. I suppose there's probably going to be, because I mean, like, you know, the conversation that we're having now, this is only after one round of battles. I suspect once you and others play the semi-final rounds, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that none of us have thought about now. And so I hope that a few months from now, when we have a tournament champion, and we're able to look back and take a long view as to how everything panned out, then we'd get closer to the answer. Although, I have to remember that that D60 C7 thing should probably not be allowed to exist in a tournament setting, like having both at once. So that's at least one good thing out of the conversation. But Klingons might not agree. They might be, the Klingons might be like, "How dare you take away my two cool ships?" But you know, I do feel that you know, drone empires, you know, they get way too much in Starfleet battles as it is. So they need to learn how to play nice with the rest of the
Falcons. Oh, yeah. That reminds me. I'm not sure if you remember this, Gary. In Federation Commander, is there a limitation to the number of drones that are in a ship that, you know, reloads? I forget.
Drones work a little bit differently in Fed Commander.
Oh, I know they do. I know they do.
For one thing. No, you're right. Sorry. I'm just like, my brain's trying to work out how to answer your question. let's see. So on the one thing, Now, Fed Commander does have the concept of fast drones
right.
if you play a scenario set in the year 2580 or later.
Right.
But I don't believe the Fed Commander tournament was set then. I'm pretty sure it was set in before then. So the Empire still had only speed 24 drones.
Right.
Now, in terms of the drone racks, with the exception of the Federation, everybody has a Type A rack.
Right.
So you get four drones, but you do have to reload it, but you get infinite reloads.
Right.
And
that's what I thought.
The Federation, they get a Type G rack, which comes with two drones and four anti-drones.
Right.
Now, Type 6 drones don't exist in Fed Commander, so those ADD spots on the G-rack are, in fact, anti-drones. But the same again, I think you have to take a full turn to reload them. That doesn't seem to have been a problem for Drone Empires in Fed Commander. But see, part of the issue in FedCom is that the ships themselves are so fast because, you know, you don't pay for housekeeping and you don't have a difference between warp and impulse power. And you also, you don't have speed limits. Like, for example, you know, in Federation, in Starfy battles,
yeah.
your ship can only accelerate. Like, if you start the game at speed zero, you have to take a couple of turns to get up to speed 30 or something like that.
Yep.
You don't have a positron flywheel. But in Federation Commander, every ship has a positron flywheel. So you can actually set, in the energy allocation of any turn, whatever speed you want. And you can pay additional points to either accelerate or decelerate as the game goes. So it's like everyone's flying an X ship. You're basically flying in the sense that you're relying on your reserve power significantly more in FedCom than you are in Starfleet Battles. So for all those reasons, that's been the number one problem that I believe Plasma Empires have had there, because there's no stable plasma in Fed Commander. But because enemy ships are A, so fast, and B, can accelerate so quickly, they can escape plasma much faster. And if you're on a closed map, like if you're fighting over a planet or a base or something,
mm-hmm.
then Plasma Empires can leverage that more easily. But if you're in open space, you're in a lot of trouble. And that's, I think, been the core of what the issue was in the tournament as well, because unless you had, like, if you kind of got things a bit weird in terms of having, like, a Romulan fleet with as many Plasma Arcs as possible, then the other Empires could just scoot around and wait for your torpedoes to run out, and then they've got two turns, because there's no pseudo-plasmas in Fed Commander either, so the other knows that you have to wait three turns to launch again, so they can come in and deck you while you're doing it. So, but many of those issues don't apply in Starfleet Battles
right.
To the same way.
Right.
Although I do wish Starfleet Battles made you pay twice to fly backwards, though. But,
yeah, there's
but
other...
Yeah, I'm trying to get back to the...
Yeah.
Like
oh,
you were saying,
yeah. I agree. And one thing. The reason why I asked that was just because of it just points out that the Federation Commander, it simplifies things and so forth. And there's certain good things about it, like there's no wild weasels, there's no sabo, there's no enveloping torpedoes, there's no T bombs. In Federation Commander, so there's a big difference in the way things fly when it comes to offenses and defenses. But the point is that I don't think really reloads really make that big of a difference. I really don't.
But the flip side is that the Federation Commander really cuts back on the number of options you have for your drones. So, for example,
that's
Type
correct.
4 drones don't exist. Type 6 don't exist, as we're saying. There's no Spearfish drones. There's no Starfish. There's no multi-warhead drones. There's no drone construction. There's no all those horrible things that AB gave to Drone Empires over 40 years of survey battles. Like, it's, you know, you can't spring surprises the same way that you can in survey battles. But actually, the other thing as well is... it's not so much an issue between Drone Empire users or over the Lyrans for that matter, because ESGs and Spider-Verse Commander are quite interesting. I almost wish the Starfleet Battles ESGs had that same activation mode.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in Fed Commander, an ESG literally is a sphere that expands from the ship. It's like you use it and then it hits everything in the hex of the ship and then everything in the surrounding hexes. And so it literally kind of bursts at the all the CQ weapons and pushes them out, rather than you having a hollow sphere that follows the ship around.
Yeah, that forms at a certain radius, yeah.
Yeah, but actually, here's the thing. If we ever do get to Module X2, I think it'd be cool if Balearans were given a new activation mode for the ESG that was that.
Yeah. Oh, agree. I agree there. It's just on that rabbit.
But yeah, so I think it's just more that because if you remember when Klingon Border was created, the initial focus was getting the Feds and the Klingons right, and the Xintis as well, that I think the fact that the Romulans and Gorans had to wait to be in the third published module, because Romulan Border came out after Klingon Border and Klingon Attack, mm-hmm. the game had already been lined up in such a way that it suited the disruptors and drones. And then plasma had to be inserted into that in a way that was functional, and maybe it was a bit trickier. So, like, what would Fed Commander look like if the Romulan border side had been done first and the Klingons came after that? Would it be any different? Maybe it wouldn't be. Maybe some of the underlying concepts might have been a little bit different.
I think overall,
how people were expected to play it. So,
yeah. I feel like they wouldn't have been changed all that much just because of that it was based off of SFB, which is already predetermined. You know, there might have been some minor changes when it comes to thinking, but I don't think much. Oh, a couple things. Obviously, who was it? Eddie. Yeah, Eddie. Two things that I think were good ideas. Okay. When it comes to terrain, I mean the map, there should be either one or two things. One, it's, you know, they used to fly basically two maps, as in a 60 by 42 map. So it's like two maps, for, you know, end to end, so it's like an elongated map. Having something kind of smaller than that, I think would be a good idea. Okay, another possibility is to have some kind of terrain, i.e. a planet or asteroid, whatever. Let's say an asteroid in the middle of the map. Actually, I prefer a planet. The reason why I prefer a planet because it actually can be acting as terrain, i.e. if you fly around it and you keep close to it, because there's a good reason to keep close to it, because you actually can, when it comes to the line of sight, you actually, the planet can block line of sight of the weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it'd be kind of cool. And then have it so that, you know, obviously the floating map based on the planet. That if you go a certain distance from the planet, you know, disengage and so forth. And you're disengaged that way. Number two, which I think is excellent, because I was just reading up on this, which was I was reading up on the limitations. And he points this out, I think, excellent idea, which is have a start date, stepping start date of Y180, have a start date of Y178. Drone speeds, for when it comes to fast drones are limited quantities. So, yeah, you can get fast drones. You can actually have a number of fast drones, but there's only so many fast drones that you can have based on, you know, I think it's limit, which is, I think it's 10%. Your drones can actually be fast drones at Y178. So, you know, so it gives people a possibility of actually, drones can still be used as terrain, but they won't be this all-powerful weapon. Yeah, some other things. But number two, which I double-checked and I definitely confirmed it, round two is going to be an interesting round in that, okay, we have Madman, which is Dana, versus Librarian, which is Ed. Now, Ed has a scout. Dana, no scout. And of course, I'm fighting Meldog, Justin. Justin, he has a scout. Me? No scout. So it's going to be, in my mind, interesting battles in that we'll see how effective the use of scouts are versus a fleet with no scouts is.
Paul, just a reminder, Dana's fleet does have a D6D, so it does have a scout.
Yeah, but a D6D is not a scout. It has special sensors, but it's not classified as a scout. If it's classified as a scout, it should be worth more.
Yeah, but it basically has the same effect. In a sense. Unless it's like severely limited in what it can use the special sensors for.
Because it is considered to be a scout in the sense that because once you've got the special sensors on there, it's a scout. Even if it's not basically a pure scout in the sense that it's focusing on the sensors more. Like, for example, the D6S has more sensors, and it's meant to be more used as like an electronic support platform. Mm-hmm. So it's a better scout than the D6D, but the D6D is still, from the in terms of like the drawing up the S8 rules, it would still count as a scout. So, I mean, you're right. They should probably double-check the BPV. I'm sure Jeff Clark has the numbers buried somewhere, just to make sure that everything is okay.
Yeah.
How about a gas giant?
No. Well, in theory, yeah,
with
maybe.
With some rings around it.
I understand the idea, but I think
the map could be a basic guy like you, just fighting around.
Actually, what would really be cool would be actually an asteroid field, but okay.
That's a bit much.
Yeah, that's a bit much, I'd say. But yeah, for when it comes to, you know, regular BPV kind of configurations, the D6D has a flat value of 113. All right.
Let's double check that. It's module R3, or is it advanced mission?
Yeah, I'm looking at module G3, master index.
Oh, G3. Okay, so I'm just going to check in because I'm just going to see if I can find the actual SSD. But does it say on the... I'm pretty sure it's the R3. Is that the one it's in?
I need to see if it's marked in... AM.
Oh, advanced missions. Okay.
Yep.
There you go. I'm trying to find it here.
If you can find that.
Although I should say that the D6D, regardless of what the base cost is, if you're flying it in Y180, it gets quite expensive because you have to pay for all of the fast drones. So you basically have to pay, I think it's like, is it 2 points or something like that? Two and a half points or something for every, maybe 1 point or something for, because you don't have to pay for the reloads, but you have to pay for the... all of the drone spaces on every drone rack for it to fast drone level.
Right. And
if you're going to be using it in Y180.
And also, the one thing you need to remember about your reloads and what's in your reloads, they must match the racks at the beginning of the scenario. So if you have swordfish drones, you have fast drones, That loadout has to be what you have. Any special drones so far have to be in the drone racks. Now, if you want to, you know, you might have some non-fast drones in your racks, you know, that you paid for. You have to spend the time to basically shut down the racks, take them offline, and then change what the loadout is on turn two. Basically, if you want to change it so that if you had some non-fast drones, they have like all fast drones, you'd actually have to spend a whole turn, possibly that. And I actually have to check to see. I forget how much. Remember that I'd use crew actions to change. This is always fun. I'm trying to find whether it's.
Okay, so I'm looking at the
I can't find
SSD
it. Is it
here.
down at the bottom? I'm trying to find
It was
what.
here.
Oh, there they are. Okay, so if it's a star, it's considered a scout. Okay, so the diamond is a scout. Okay. So D60 is actually considered a scout. Even
Well,
though
yeah, it
it
has all the
even though it
Yeah,
doesn't
so
have
it's
a split value.
So it's got
Well, maybe it wasn't used for
six strong
exploration,
glass.
and that's
They're all
why. It's a
well, it was more
bombardment
basically
ship,
because
not an exploration boat.
yeah.
yeah, because the yeah the sensors are supposed to be used to the ship basically stocks up with Type 3 extended range drones, and then can use the sensors to guide them to like a distant object. So like say for example, if you're ever playing a battle and there's like drones kind of coming in from off the map, it's ships like this that are launching them. But it is also possible to bring it into the actual battle. But yeah, I do feel that you should basically have only it or a C7 in terms of being a specialist ship. I think it's a bit much to let people have both. Because I mean, like, say if the Klingons take like a drone war destroyer, I mean, those don't have special sensors, but also they're smaller and easier to kill. So, like, there's a kind of innate balance factor there. Like, you have to try to get the drones out before your ship gets blown up. And so maybe that would be, because like when you've got the special sensors, it's not just about adding control, seeking weapon control. You can basically give yourself ECM, so you're making it, your primary drone platform is making itself that much harder to kill, which is fine in the fleet, like in the role the ship is designed to have historically, in like Federation and Empire terms. But I just don't know if it's a good idea for the tournament, like to have it and be able to play around with that C7. C7's a main ship. So yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. It shouldn't just be the Klingons. I think the Kzintis should be under the same thing. Maybe the Carnivons too, because the Carnivons have a. Although I don't think Death Bolts have a Type 3 engine. Like you can't bombard off map with the. I mean, they do have a bombardment variant, but I think you have to be a lot closer to the targets with the Carnivon cruiser rather than with the Kzinti or Klingon drone cruisers, because they're not intended to be, super extended range the way the drones can be. So, but yeah. Okay. So yeah, definitely. There's some people that say that ADB have a lot of Klingon favoritism when it comes to the game. And I don't want to say that's true, but
Oh, come on.
like sometimes
Come
you
on. Deep Paul is very, he loves his Klingons. He truly does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you'll be faulted for that statement at this point.
Agreed.
Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah,
Anyway,
but
so yeah, basically, I guess I don't want to. I know we probably should wrap things up soon because I'm sure
yes,
you've
definitely, because
got a whole bunch of stuff to do. But to be continued. But basically, long
Oh,
story short
yeah.
is, A, I think a rerun of that Gorn Klingon fight with A, allowing the Gorns to take the. Well, I mean, they already as in giving the having the Gorns take that heavy battle destroyer with the Type D racks. And B, tweaking the rules so that the Klingons get to have a C7 or a D60. I think that would actually be that actually does. That seems like it. That sounds like it's a good idea in terms of like maybe balancing it out. I don't think Dana would agree, but I feel that maybe that's a fairer way to approach. And then you can basically take a slower and steadier, chipping away at the changes that need to be made in time for the autumn tournament.
Right.
Rather than, I guess, panicking too much now. Does that sound good? Okay. Because I didn't want it to be sound like it was just one
Interesting.
of those things where, like,
Well,
you think of it on the spur of the moment and then it turns out it's a terrible idea. I mean, like,
yeah.
it might still be a terrible idea, but.
Yeah, because definitely, as Dana pointed out, I was just checking it just to confirm, and it is confirmed. Which is basically D6D drone cruiser is that it's just exactly that. It is a drone cruiser. It has no quote unquote heavy weapons, except for drones. That's all it does. It launches drones. And I think that the E4, those little puckers, actually, I think they have, like, they have E4. Bringing it up. E4. Yeah, it has two disruptors, but also, if I call correctly, they're limited with range 15. So when it comes to this, the NS fleet, basically, it's designed for one thing, one thing only, which is just launching drones. And then coming in close and hitting people with disruptors. But even so, the biggest issue with these little freaking E4 escorts is that they don't have a lot of power. They really don't. Unless they stop, they won't be able to overload both disruptors, which will cost them 8 points of power. And what they got, 12, 14, 15, total 15 power. And it's going to cost them 3 points of energy.
We're here.
Yeah, 3 points.
I should check and see, because I'm pretty sure that there's a drone version of the D5 as well, but I don't think it has special sensors. So, I mean,
I think it does.
For example, imagine if a version of Dana's Squadron.
I think it does.
Okay. But maybe there's like a smaller.
I think you're right that there is a specialized one like that
would be permissible that doesn't have seeking weapons that you could say, yes, you can take this on the Torrent if you want. But if it's a drone platform with special sensors, then, you know.
And the flip side of all this is that this kind of actually makes the argument for having a set choose your pre-generated fleet thing instead of customizing it.
Right. Agreed. Okay. Well, gentlemen.
Okay.
I think it's time to wrap up. Actually, it should have been wrapped up like 15 minutes ago. But it was a good conversation, and I definitely didn't want to stop it. So.
Thank you so much.
Yep, Gary, it's been a pleasure having you on. And Lord knows there's going to be more discussion, I'm sure, in the 500 BPV tournament. I'll look through it. I didn't see anyone actually complain that I wasn't mentioning anything. The only thing I saw was that people complaining that, oh, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't get enough battle reports. That's the only complaint I heard. And that was not specifically targeted at me.
Okay. Well, I guess if you, anyway, so I'll wrap it up with that.
Yep.
But, I will say, though, the D70 doesn't have sensors, so I don't think it'd be. That seems that people. I wouldn't complain about people taking that.
Right. Also, so, again, anyway, you're right. The D5D doesn't have special sensors either. Oh.
Cool.
Yeah. So, no special sensors equals no problem. Or less of a problem, maybe.
Less of a problem because the my only question, because again, we had a. Let me just double check one quick thing, which is, Peter had a scout too. So it's not like a scout versus non-scout. So the question is, how much were they playing EW tricks with using their scouts?
Well, the question is, which scouts are acceptable to take? Because I think, for example, the Federation can't take a Galactic Survey Cruiser. So that's already basically adding in the assumption that Survey Cruisers, even though the GSE is pretty good in a fight, it's not necessarily applicable here. Whereas if you have, say, for example, a Federation new Scout Cruiser, that's meant to be a quote-unquote battle scout. So yes, you would expect to see that in a squadron like this. Maybe the same thing could apply for the Klingons and Gesintis, where sure, they have scouts that have drone racks, but it's basically a case of thinning out the herd, so to speak, in terms of making sure that they're not taking ones that are overly problematic. Or at least if they are, then they'll have to give up some other cool toy to make room for it.
Agreed. I think there might, if we continue on with this format, we're gonna have to, we really should eliminate certain ships just because of they're just too off balancing. If you want the D5D, have fun. Take all the drones. You have no scout. If you want a scout, you have to buy another ship. I'm assuming that the EW has actually had a big effect, and that's one thing I really want. Really, it's going to be, to me, it's going to be interesting in the next couple of battles, which is how do the non-scout fleets versus the scout fleets?
How just they primary scout and make it go bye-bye. Oh wait, was I speaking out loud? I'm sorry.
Hey, that's gonna be the question. That is a good question, though. Which is, what is the gonna be the beginning tactics for those fleets that don't have scouts? Is it gonna be targeting the scout? Obviously, that's gonna be pretty hard because it's probably gonna be first thing it's gonna do is gonna be protecting itself with its own special sensors. But here's the one thing I don't feel bad about those scouts, because both those scouts, the two scouts that I saw, one's a DWS and another one is a frigate. Both of them have limited power for the special sensors they have. So, it's not like you have a heavy cruiser with special sensors, which has all of that power to power the special sensors and actually move. So, makes things interesting, I think. My guess is that the scouts will be in the back of the fleets, heavily protected by everybody else.
I guess we'll see.
Yes, we'll see. Well, Gary, it was a pleasure having you around. Yeah, you have a good night.
Hey, same to you, and best of luck in the next round.
Okay, thank you. Doug, as always, it's good having you around.
Oh, thank you. It's awesome being here. Also, we have Gamers of Summer coming up eventually.
Yes, we do.
And just for anybody listening, if you want to and you're inclined and maybe thinking about coming out, I did put up a multiple poster selection thing on the discussion thread.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I threw that up there was if somebody likes a particular version of the small poster, I'm considering printing those out as a 4x4 on a 12x16 so they can be cut up, mm-hmm. and have a stack of them and just take them out to local game shop in your area, that sort of thing. Or if you just want to print the thing out yourself,
mm-hmm.
or take it to a local printer and say, here, print me 10 of these. I want to put these out at different places, blah, blah, blah. Go for it. It's on the... It's on the thread,
in Facebook.
The Facebook thread, group. And basically, I believe I did the event picture on Facebook using one of the multiple variations, and basically, it's just a variation in color schemes. So if you think color scheme A1, 2, or 3 is good, and I get enough feedback, then I'll print out what comes back from the feedback to give to the people who want to put them out. So there's that.
Okay.
Or take them to other conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't expect anybody from Seattle to fly out to our event, but I could easily see somebody coming in from New Jersey, Baltimore, any place that's just a few hours away.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really are basically want to come out and spend 10, 12 hours, 14 hours of your day playing SFB or F&E or something of that nature, and can maybe talk a few friends into coming along. Hey, you know, it's at a hotel that's not too expensive, and there's plenty of cheaper places in the area.
Yeah,
to stay out if you want to stay there and drive over.
Yep. Oh, yeah. It's very good variety of restaurants.
A good variety of restaurants and a good variety of hotels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could literally stay at, you know, Ye Olde Fleabag Hotel if you want to for $100 a night or whatever, or you could stay at this place for $150 to $200, depending on how much they're getting booked for. Now, it is Labor Day weekend, big travel weekend. That might make it a little more difficult, but on that part. But in the wintertime, if we're still there, that part is up in the air because they're still talking about selling the building, transitioning it into something else. But, you know, hopefully by this summer we'll know about whether we'll be back there in the winter or not. Because I like the venue.
Oh, yeah.
I really do.
We found some really good venues in the past, and this is one of the good ones. You know?
Yeah, this is one of the best ones we've had, and, you know, that's basically it. I mean, it's either renovation or some other random thing that has gotten us, you know, changing venues over the years. So renovation plus jacking of cost.
Mm-hmm.
Renovation into a different purpose has been a couple of them. Now, that's why we didn't go back to the Wyndham. They took the space away. They literally renovated into a different use.
Yep.
Instead of a ballroom restaurant, it became a open space cafe thing. You know, the last firehouse that we were at, they just decided they were going to use that for totally different purpose than renting out to the public. So, yeah.
Well,
we shall see. Oh, and also, yeah, please send me your list so I can add it to the events page.
Will do. Will do.
It's not too early. Hint, hint.
So. I know. It's a lot of times you have to drag it out of me.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, we've got like the earlier we can put events in, the more people see events.
Right.
Understood. I sometimes wonder if us not having 3,000 events listed is a reason that we don't get people coming out. You know, I mean, at this point, when you say gaming convention to most people, they don't think of MeepaCon or our event or other small events like this. They think of Origins. They think of the Philly Game Expo thing. You know, they think of large events with thousands of people that as soon as they open up their events for registration, they've got hundreds to thousands of events listed. You know, and, you know, all those GMs coming in so that the literal thousands of people that go to that event have something to do, and they look at ours and there's like half a dozen things listed, or if I'm really lucky, we get a dozen things listed. So, but some of those things are actually pretty big. I mean, like the D&D people might be, you know, one listing, here's their website, but they've got three events a day for 2 days, and sometimes three events on one day, 2 days, two on the other, and they've got two or three tables. So, I don't know. Just get me your event so I can list it.
Hey, will do. Will do.
And also, yeah, I'll hang out for a minute so we can talk afterwards.
Okay. Okay. Well, you have a good night.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. So, nice little discussion about the 500 BPV tournament. It's going to be, see if I can maybe add a few, little bit of my own voice to it and see what happens. Sorry, I just saw Justin's overbearing responses. Yeah, everyone actually even had Peter going, dude, what the WTF, man, you know? So yeah, whatever. But anyway, yeah, there was, I think it was good discussion. Hopefully things will maybe settle down a little bit. I'm hoping maybe this weekend, if not this weekend, maybe next weekend, to get started with Justin in our tournament game, which should be interesting. As I said, he's got his scout. I have to double check to see what his setup is, because I have a scout and I'd like to see. I'm not too terribly concerned about drones. I'm really not. I'm used to dealing with drones. I know how to deal with drones. Obviously, the biggest issue is going to be the number of fast drones that are going to be available. I understand that. And there's some specialty drones. Now, obviously, there's a limitation on the specialty drones. There's racial limitations on those drones. So, you know, if you have some stingrays, okay, you have some stingrays. Okay, so it's going to fire phaser at me. Oh, wow, that's going to hurt. You know, it's going to, so, it's tough to wait and see about that. So, anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.